Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this President's Day with the latest survey conducted by 170 members of the American Political Science Association's Presidents and Executive Politics section on presidential legacies and the rankings and ratings of our presidents over the nation's history. The co-author of the report, Justin Vaughan, a professor of political science and the director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics at Boise State University, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, How Does Trump Stack Up Against the Best and Worst Presidents? We'll assess the recent presidential legacies that have soared, like President Obama's, going up from 18th place in 2014 to 8th place today, and those that have declined, like President Clinton and Andrew Jackson, who's embraced by Donald Trump, along with changing attitudes over Jackson's treatment of Native Americans, might have added to his demise, particularly since our current president has replaced James Buchanan as the worst president in America's history, with Donald Trump, after just 1 year in office, placed at the bottom. Then, as Trump tweets out a storm of petulant self-obsession instead of acting presidential as the comforter-in-chief for the grieving families in Florida, we find our president on President's Day blaming the FBI's failure to flag the school shooter on the Bureau spending too much time investigating him in the Russia probe. An expert on presidential rhetoric, Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, joins us to discuss Trump's human failure and rhetorical priorities, as if the pain the parents are going through is an afterthought compared to Trump's preoccupation with himself and the legal jeopardy he might be in. Then finally, we will speak with Nancy McLean, a professor of history and public policy at Duke University and the award-winning author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She joins us to discuss how much the press and public are distracted by Trump's daily headline-grabbing antics, while behind the scenes, the Republicans are making every bit of the Koch brothers' agenda the law of the land, as America more and more drifts away from democracy towards plutocracy. And joining us now is Justin Vaughan, professor and the director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics at Boise State University, where his research focuses on American political institutions with an emphasis on executive politics. He has an article at the New York Times with Brandon Rottenhouse, How Does Trump Stack Up Against the Best and Worst Presidents? Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Vaughan.
Thanks for having me on.
This survey that you've done is not the first one. So tell us about the methodology. The previous survey was in 2014, and I believe that the survey involves 170 members of the American Political Science Association's Presidents and Executive Politics sections who fill out your survey. So tell us about the methodology and how long you've been doing it, and then we'll get into how on this President's Day you've come up with this finding about who is America's worst president.
Yeah, so we did it for the first time in 2014, and we did it again just for the second time over this winter. And the way we do it is we survey all the members of the Presidents and Executive Politics section of the American Political Science Association, so the premier organization for executive politics scholars who are social scientists. And we send out an invitation to those members to complete the survey via an online software program. And then, you know, after a few weeks when everybody's had enough time to be able to complete it, we close it down and calculate the results. And so one of the things that we do is we ask the respondents to give each president a score from 0 to 100 on their level of greatness. You know, so 0 would be not at all great. 100 is totally great. And 50 is an average presidency. And then we calculate the averages for each of those presidents, and we put them in the ranked order, and that allows us to conclude what at least political scientists think about who the best and the worst presidents are. And then this year, we were able to not only do that, but we were able to kind of calculate who saw the most change. You know, Abraham Lincoln was going to be at the top, James Buchanan was going to be towards the bottom, but who might have risen or fallen a few rungs and why?
Well, let's start with the top. This is the good news, right?
Right.
Number one ranked president in America's history is Abraham Lincoln, followed by George Washington, followed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, followed by Teddy Roosevelt, followed by Thomas Jefferson, followed by Harry Truman, followed by President Dwight D. Eisenhower at number seven, and at number eight, Barack Obama. So that's something, isn't it? Obama shot up. He was 18th, I believe, in your previous survey.
That's right. It was the most significant change of any president from this time to the last time. And yeah, 10-point change. Went from 18th, which is kind of pretty, you know, above average, but pretty much in the middle, to top 10.
And interesting enough, the biggest decline from the 2014 survey till the current one is with Bill Clinton and also Andrew Jackson.
Right. Yeah, and I think that there's probably some explanations for that. I think mostly what you're seeing are Democrats maybe softening their enthusiasm for both of them. I think Andrew Jackson, you know, first of all, we are increasingly aware of and not tolerant of his intolerance of Native Americans, and so that continues and will continue to hurt him in these rankings. But what really kind of sped it up, I think, this time was Donald Trump's embrace of Andrew Jackson, putting the portrait of him up in the Oval Office, sends, I think, signals to Democrats that they don't want to embrace him as much as maybe they did, you know, in previous years. And Bill Clinton, I think you're seeing in a lot of different industries, and in the entertainment industry in particular, you're seeing the misbehavior of a man's past starting to catch up with him. And in this current moment, where we're very, you know, attuned to and sensitive to improprieties and sexually aggressive behavior, that I think we'll also see Bill Clinton's rankings start to tumble over the coming years.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Vaughn, who's a professor and the director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics at Boise State University, where his research focuses on American political institutions with an emphasis on the executive politics. He has an article at the New York Times, along with his co-author, Brandon Rottenhouse, How Does Trump Stack Up Against the Best and Worst Presidents? And we've done the best presidents. Let's do the worst. And I guess let's do the bottom five. Andrew Jackson, who, as you pointed out, has taken a bit of a dip, perhaps in part because Donald Trump has embraced him and put his portrait up. And that's caused a lot of Democrats to defect. William Harrison, then Harding, Buchanan, and at the very bottom, Donald Trump. Now, Buchanan's been at the bottom for some time, right? There's not been any doubt about America's worst president up until Donald Trump. And I guess he also had the peculiar distinction of being America's first gay president, did he not?
Oh, I don't know about that. There may be speculation about that, but I don't think any confirmed, you know, evidence that was true.
He lived with a U.S. senator. But in any case, I mean, I don't mean to digress. It's certainly not a proven case, and it's not that interesting, although some people may find it interesting. The reality is that he was an incompetent, right? And he served just as before the Civil War.
Yeah, regardless of his sexuality, he was a terrible president. He presided over the nation sliding into a recession. He made, you know, took actions that kind of encouraged indirectly the Confederates to become more aggressive, and ultimately, you know, leave the Union when Lincoln was elected. So really, just kind of a really, really terrible chief executive. And interestingly, other than Trump, those presidents in the bottom five, with the exception of William Henry Harrison, they're all kind of right around that Civil War era, and they, you know, history has judged them to have been on the wrong side of the slavery issue, to have made missteps with respect to the nation going into and being in a civil war. Andrew Johnson was the president after Lincoln was assassinated, and you know, did just about anything he could to undermine the Union's effort in the South during Reconstruction. You know, Franklin Pierce was president prior to Lincoln, but then was a Copperhead, was a Southern sympathizer during the Civil War. Even though he was from the North, he was allied with the South, and of course Buchanan has a lot of the blame for us going into the Civil War. William Henry Harrison doesn't really deserve to be in the bottom five. He the only thing he did wrong was die early. He caught pneumonia when he was delivering his inaugural address, and he died a month later. And so he often comes in very poorly in these surveys, not because he did anything wrong, but because he did nothing to be great. And so he has the historic misfortune to be remembered with a bunch of incompetent pro-slavery chief executives, and now apparently Donald Trump.
Well, some of the presidents, though, who are held in high regard, like Ronald Reagan, not surprising, he's at number nine, which is pretty high up. But Jack Kennedy, JFK, who's quite beloved, Chris Matthews just done a book about the Kennedys and actually mostly about Bobby Kennedy, but as you know, there's a lot of affection for them in the Democratic Party. Kennedy, surprising enough, JFK is at number 16, just ahead of George H.W. Bush, who's at number 17. Jimmy Carter's at number 26. George W. Bush is at number 30, right? And Richard Nixon is at number 33. And again, need I remind us all on this President's Day that our current president, Donald Trump, is at the very bottom of the heap at number 44. So what kind of pushback are you getting? I mean, obviously, this is inherently a bipartisan list, right? You're not taking sides here, right?
No, yeah. We invited the entire section to be a participant. There are more Democrats than Republicans in that section. And so the overall results are going to skew in the way that the Democrats rated things. But that's why we then broke out separate scores for what the Republicans said and what the independents said. And, I think the biggest pushback we tend to get is when people say, oh, well, you know, this is silly to do, or how could you possibly evaluate somebody who's only in office for a year, right? John F. Kennedy famously complained to Arthur Schlesinger when he saw the results of one of these surveys, you know, back when he was still alive, and said, how could these people possibly know what's like to be a president and to be good or bad? And there is something to that argument that this is a fun but maybe ultimately not essential exercise. But I think it does give us, at least for Trump and for Obama too, it does give us very early indications about how historical reputations are going to evolve. And I don't know if Donald Trump will ever see this article, and if he does, I don't know what he'll think about it. But what he could decide to think about it is that, you know, right now, if I continue on the path that I'm on, I'm going to be in pretty ignoble company for the rest of history. But if I change some things, then I could avoid that kind of historical curse.
Well, it is pretty extraordinary to see how quickly reputations go up and down. As you pointed out, Barack Obama has had a meteoric rise from 18th place to number 8. And it's true that a lot of people are wondering, you know, looking back at him rather wistfully and with a great deal of nostalgia. And it's an amazing how quickly things can change. And as you said, you know, maybe it's a little premature to judge Trump, although I think a lot of people, me included, are of the impression that things are actually getting worse under Trump in terms of his own presidency and his own behavior. Particularly over this last weekend, where he thought he was vindicated by the Mueller indictment and then apparently was watching TV, which he does. I think he spends up to 8 hours a day actually watching TV. He's realized or recognized that the impression was that the Mueller indictments weren't helpful for him, and he went into a tweet storm. So, but as you point out, McKinley was shot shortly after he was elected. William Harrison caught a cold in his inauguration and died a month later. So some of the presidents, there's not a lot to go on, right? Is that a way to put it?
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, if you look at we don't know what would have happened with the rest of McKinley's term, right, or John F. Kennedy's term. And so we only are able to judge, you know, what we have right now. And with Trump right now, with the exception of, you know, successfully putting Gorsuch on the Supreme Court early in his term and the tax cut bill, there are very few substantive accomplishments for him to point to. There's not a lot of substantive setbacks either. You know, we kind of clear the smoke a little bit. We can see that the Trump administration has not been very effective so far in any way. And so, you know, in another year, in 2 years, in 3 years, if a similar survey is done, I think you'll see you'll probably see some movement, if only because there's more substantively to judge him on and less. And right now, I think what scholars have to go on is his behavior, his demeanor, you know, and a lot of what he does, from his staffing of the executive branch to his, you know, tweeting, is counter to what we have come to expect, you know, from the occupant of the White House, whether that's a Republican or a Democrat.
Well, Justin Vaughn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
And thank you again for giving us a President's Day briefing on the rankings of presidents. And I've been speaking with Justin Vaughn, a professor of political science and director of the Center for Idaho Study and Politics at Boise State University, where his research focuses on American political institutions with an emphasis on executive politics. And he has an article at the New York Times along with Brandon Rottenhouse, How Does Trump Stack Up Against the Best and Worst Presidents? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Trump's tweet storm of petulant self-obsession instead of acting presidential as the comforter-in-chief for the grieving families in Florida.
Instead of spending billions on the war, I can use that money so I can feed the poor. 'Cause I know some so poor. When it rains, that's when they shower, scream and fight the power. That's when the vulture devours. If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the president. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
Thank you for having me on today.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. On this President's Day, it would seem to be an appropriate conversation, particularly your forthcoming book on the Trump presidency's campaign and its demagoguery. Over this weekend, Donald Trump has apparently been in a fit and a fury. Initially, he thought, at least his interpretation of the 37-page indictments coming down from Robert Mueller vindicated him, but apparently over the weekend down at Mar-a-Lago, where he wasn't able to golf out of an understanding that it wasn't going to be a particularly good optic for him out on the golf course while people are burying their dead from the high school in Florida nearby, he apparently watched an awful lot of television and got furious that he wasn't being vindicated by the Mueller indictments. And it feels like the inquiry is closing in on him. At least he's acting a bit like a trapped animal in a paranoid fashion. What did you make of this tirade of tweets?
He certainly did take to Twitter this weekend in an attempt to defend himself. That's true. He's not used to being criticized. He doesn't handle it well. All accounts are that the people who are close to him try to manage the information that he receives. So that means that he receives mostly positive information about himself and how his presidency is going. And so it probably came to him as a little bit of a surprise to see himself criticized so much on cable news and whatnot this weekend. So, yeah, Twitter was definitely lashing out.
Well, how much though longer can he keep blaming Hillary Clinton? I mean, she lost the elections. She's basically keeping a pretty low profile. Apparently, she's, you know, sort of racked with guilt and feels terrible about what's happened. And I imagine she's living with a great burden of guilt that she lost and should have won. But yet he keeps piling on. Do you think it's working? I mean, here he is in his last tweet, by the way, attacking his own national security advisor for what he'd said at the security conference in Munich. This is Trump's tweet at 8:22 p.m. on February the 17th. General McMaster forgot to say that the results of the 2016 elections were not impacted or changed by the Russians, and that the only collusion was between Russia and Crooked H, the DNC and the Dems. Remember the dirty dossier, uranium speeches, emails, and the Podesta company. I mean, this is an extraordinary fiction that he's developed, and of course it's been echoed and amplified by Fox News. But is there any, I mean, how long can he inhabit that world of delusion while Mueller is finding out more and more about his role as opposed to the imaginary role of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic question. It definitely appears that he has developed a narrative, whether it's him that has started the narrative or whether he's echoing a narrative that's already been out there on the right, furthest edges of the right wing. It's hard to tell, you know, who starts things on the internet today. But yeah, he has a developed, coherent worldview. And so what he's arguing is consistent with the story that he's developed all along, which is Hillary Clinton is evil and is responsible for all bad things. If not Hillary Clinton, then Hillary Clinton in conjunction with Barack Obama are responsible for all bad things. Or the Democratic Party is in, you know, cahoots with all these things. And he does not accept responsibility for any of his actions. That's been clear throughout the campaign and throughout the presidency. So he's not willing to accept responsibility for anything now. And to be fair, you know, Mueller hasn't indicted him yet or maybe won't be. So, you know, maybe it's not yet time for him to be accepting responsibility. But I wonder and I worry, frankly, that he never will. And I don't know what happens if that comes to pass.
But normally a president, and particularly at a time of tragedy like the shooting of the high school down in Florida, would become the kind of the parent figure, if you will, the comforting father as the nation mourns. Instead, his tweets are all about himself, as though he doesn't give a damn about these kids and the families that lost these young, wonderful young kids. He said, very sad that the FBI missed all of the many signals sent by the Florida school shooter. This is not acceptable. They are spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. There is no collusion. So, again, that to me is you know, I imagine, do you think any people out there in the middle of America, not the people inside the Fox bubble or the people inside the MSNBC bubble, but do you think the people in the middle there, are they reacting to this in a way like, wait a minute, you know, can't you just stop thinking about yourself for a minute and think about those grieving families?
Yeah, so we talk about that as the priestly role of the presidency. So during moments of national crisis, external threats, internal crises, whichever it is, the president has a kind of function or an obligation to console the nation and to lead through the crisis, right? So to figure out a way of uniting the nation to make us feel better about what has happened, or to lead in such a way that we can see how to move forward as a nation. President Trump has not been good at fulfilling the priestly function of the White House, which is a tragedy. I mean, in and of itself, aside from the actual tragedies that he hasn't let us out of. But if you think about what a true leader would have done over this weekend, it would have been things like convening thought leaders about, how to respond to either or both the gun crisis in America and also the attack on our elections, right? He would be seen being very busy, consoling people, meeting with people, putting plans in place, really trying to figure out ways to unite the nation, to solve the nation's problems. We didn't see any of that this weekend. And so we are leaderless right now. The president is not performing the role that the president ought to perform. And so I think, yeah, middle America, probably the left and the right wing, we all sort of feel lost.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, and historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. So in terms of Donald Trump sort of pushing the envelope in terms of rhetoric that's not normally associated with presidents, much of which has been extremely undignified, crude, and often embarrassing, what's going on, though, with these revelations about a porn star being paid off by the $130,000? Trump's lawyer actually admitted doing it, as though somehow that was going to get Trump off the hook. And we know that the National Enquirer buried stories, bought stories from a Playmate model and buried them because the guy that runs the National Enquirer, David Pecker, is a close personal friend of Trump's. So how do you think that's playing? I mean, I suppose to some extent, some of his supporters may think, wow, porn star and a Playmate model, I wish I was that lucky, But on the other hand, I think with the Me Too movement and other awakenings across the country about misogyny and mistreatment of women, how do you see that in sort of playing out in the overall political landscape?
Yeah, I guess I preface this, and you can probably tell the direction that my comment will go based on this, but as a historian of American presidential discourse, I never thought that I would ever have to answer questions about paying off porn stars, right? It is absolutely indecorous. There are reasons why we hold public officials to high standards. It's because these are the people who represent America and American values. They represent the nation to foreign countries, and we want to look up to that person who we've elected to be president. We want them to be a dignified person, a person worthy of our respect, and we want them to act with decorum and dignity. I think that Donald Trump hasn't done that. What he has shown us in these stories, and I think that in some ways these stories have been buried in the last few days because of other bigger stories. So who knows how they'll play out. But, what we've seen is that, again, Donald Trump has multiple, I think they call them redundant systems of preventing himself from being held accountable. So stories leak that he's done these things. He's cheated on his wife. He's had these affairs. And instead of, being accountable to that, he has a lawyer who's a fixer who can pay people off. And instead of allowing the stories to be made into news, right, he has willing accomplices throughout the media who pay off these people. And so, again, what we see is a very coherent system where he has allowed himself to act with impunity throughout his life. He has created ways he can act without anyone ever telling him he's done wrong or holding him accountable. This is absolutely the antithesis of the American constitutional system, which is a system designed to prevent, literally prevent, people like him from ever ever seizing the reins of power through checks and balances. And when I say people like him, I mean people who refuse to allow themselves to be held accountable. An unaccountable leader is a demagogue.
Well, just in closing, Jennifer Mechie, normally I cover national security affairs, and I had James Risen on yesterday, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times, who actually President Obama went after because he broke the story about NSA wiretapping. So we were talking about his article called "Is Donald Trump a Traitor?" And that's obviously a very provocative title. But again, going back to the Trump constituency who may not find it problematic that Trump paid off a porn star and his friends at the National Enquirer buried a story about his affair with a playmate model, a playmate, I guess that's what they call. So my sense is that that the Mueller indictment that was just handed down, I think it pretty clearly exposes Putin's MO of dividing America. And that was the function, I think, of Donald Trump. The Russians didn't expect him to win, but they thought that he would sow division. And he'd already laid the groundwork. If Hillary Clinton were elected, he said that the election was a fraud and his people would have been angry. And he would have gone around the country for the next 4 years holding rallies saying, lock her up, lock her up. But I think this, the Putin MO, in terms of Donald Trump being a tool, if either witting or unwitting, we don't know that. And that, I guess, is what Mueller is looking into. I think the whole attacks on Obama that preceded the attacks on Hillary Clinton were out of the same Putin playbook. I mean, why else do you think Donald Trump went came forward with all of this ugliness about Obama not having a birth certificate and being some kind of Kenyan interloper? Because it's what I think what that achieved was it laid the groundwork for the divisions in America, and in effect gave the people who ended up being Trump supporters permission to be racist again.
Yeah, I think it did. I think that the birther controversy preceded Trump. I think that he took advantage of that to connect himself to a particular part of the right-wing and Republican electorate. You know, that was always sort of not a part of the mainstream Republican conversation. And so when he started to say that, you know, he sort of brought that into Fox and Friends and some of these other places where maybe it hadn't been. I think that that was strategic on his part. I don't know if Russia was a part of that, frankly. You know, I don't know if we can know that. Maybe we'll find out that it was. But, I mean, he was being advised by people who had been listening to a lot of right-wing talk radio and had been on message boards and things like that. And they were telling him, you know, these are kinds of the hot-button issues that people are starting to talk about. Or, you know, these are the memes that are circulating. And you know, he's kind of a conspiracy theorist. He's someone who doesn't trust anything that he doesn't, you know, control the information about. If he can't see it himself or you know, create it or whatever, he doesn't trust other people's information. So I think that he's very willing to tread in conspiracy theory, and I think that he took advantage of a pre-existing argument about Obama to kind of rise to popularity. But I don't know if Russia had anything to do with that. Maybe.
Well, we'll wait and see. It's just a theory of mine. So,
I look forward to finding out.
Yes. Well, I thank you for joining us on this President's Day. Yeah. Jennifer Mechie, thanks again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And again, I mean, speaking with Jennifer Mechie, who's a professor And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Magia, who is a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, and historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the president. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency, and she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how much the press and public are distracted by Trump's daily headline-grabbing antics instead of looking at how the Republicans are making every bit of the Koch brothers' agenda the law of the land. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this President's Day is Nancy MacLean, an award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy and Change, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy MacLean.
It's good to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Nancy, and One of the traps that we've all fallen into, and particularly journalists, and that is we cover Trump because of the antics. He's been putting out a tweet storm over the weekend, as you know. He's obviously sort of something of a trapped animal now as the Russia probe closes in on him, and he's acting quite hysterically. But meanwhile, a lot of mendacious legislation is being passed, and the country is moving away from its democratic roots into a more empowered plutocracy. And if you look at what's going on, everything that's been achieved so far by the Trump administration, by the Republican enablers, has been almost at the behest of the Koch brothers. So I think you could make a case that Donald Trump is the perfect president for the Koch brothers and other plutocrats, because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's completely ineffectual, only interested in himself and his own frail ego, and he'll sign anything that they put in front of him.
Yes, I think that you are right. I think that's a very effective characterization. And in fact, the Koch network at its most recent meeting was boasting that 2017 was, and I quote from Tim Phillips, head of Americans for Prosperity, the most productive year in the existence of this network at the federal level. So they are gloating about all that they have achieved, from the radical changes that are being pushed through in departments like the Labor Department and the Justice Department and the Education Department of Education, and also in federal agencies like the EPA, and of course the tax bill, which they also boasted that Trump's staff had involved the Koch network in talks about from day one. So they have really gotten what they wanted from this administration, and it's unfortunate that we've all been distracted by his tweets, because their agenda is moving through very quickly while we're distracted.
And that, I think, is the real problem here. Trump is the bright, shining object that distracts us from focusing on the damage that's being done rather than Trump's daily antics, because since he doesn't have any substance to him, it is effectively government by stunt or by distraction. So what do you think will get our attention, do you think, in terms of refocusing? Or is it just because, after all, you know, the mainstream press basically gave Donald Trump about $5 billion worth of free advertising in the campaign, mm-hmm. which helped elect him. So it's there's nothing new that you can, you know, manipulate the press by antics that they'll cover. Mm-hmm. So what's going to break that spell?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that I've been suggesting as I've been traveling around the country speaking about the book is time out Trump, that we all take a little break, which I think would be good for our mental health and also possibly for digestion and other purposes, and really just ignore the man. I think it's so important. Just take a week and you'll see the difference it makes to your understanding of what's happening. Take a week, ignore anything about Donald Trump, pay no attention to his tweets or the storms about them, nothing about his antics, and instead, pay attention to the parts of government that you're most concerned about, whatever your particular area is. You know, it might be civil rights, and you'll see how they are undermining civil rights enforcement in every federal department and agency. Or it might be environmental protection, and you'll see how Scott Pruitt at the EPA is absolutely gutting environmental protection and our air and water quality. You know, it could be any one of a number of different areas. But I think the key thing for people is to break that trance, you know, that tendency. It's almost like rubbernecking in an accident. You know you shouldn't be doing it, but it's a kind of compulsion. And if we break that compulsion and start paying attention to what's actually happening in areas we care about, we'll be in a stronger position to do something about it. And I think some really encouraging examples have already appeared. I mean, the fact that three times the Republican Party that's been taken over by this Koch network tried to pass very unpopular health care legislation that actually never polled above 18% support, and three times they were pushed back. That was really encouraging in terms of the mobilization of ordinary Americans, including some Republicans who just said, no way, this is awful. Now, under pressure from the Koch brothers, they pushed that change through anyway and undermined the Affordable Care Act in their tax bill. But still, it shows us what mobilization of people who are paying attention can do. And I will say, in my conversations with activists across the country from all kinds of different sectors, I am seeing people becoming more and more aware that we are at an emergency moment for our democracy, that this is an acute crisis. It's an all-hands-on-deck moment, and we all need to start paying attention. And part of paying good attention means stopping the focus on Donald Trump. As you say, he's a distraction.
And again, I'm speaking with Nancy MacLean, who's an award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. And just in terms of some of the Koch alumni, obviously, at the top of the list, you'd have Mike Pence. So they've got it covered, right?
Yes.
Somehow this guy gets impeached or gets wheeled out of the Oval Office in a straitjacket. There's Mike Pence, who's completely in the pocket of the Koch brothers, to take over. And then you've got Mark Short, one of the top people inside the White House. And then you got Mick Mulvaney, right? Budget. And he's also taken over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's moonlighting on two jobs there. Betsy DeVos at Education, Scott Pruitt at EPA. And how would you characterize Paul Ryan's relationship with the Koch brothers? Because he's certainly carrying their water.
Yes, he's utterly beholden to them. And in fact, right after the tax bill passed, they gave him, I believe it was $400 million, you know, in a kind of reward for that tax bill that they got so much from. I could be wrong about the exact figure, but it was clearly, you know, rarely do you see anything that looks so much like a quid pro quo, where someone's actually rewarded immediately after the act. But I think they were fearing the Koch network that the Republicans in Congress might be too incompetent to actually pass a bill. So when he got this bill, which is an absolute boon to them. And by the way, it's also a boon to their effort to change the Constitution, which we could come back to. But yes, Paul Ryan has been a deep loyalist of this cause and doing its bidding as best he can, you know, as is Mitch McConnell.
So the money that Paul Ryan got is to get the House reelected, right?
Right, exactly. Well, and I think it is actually a reward. You know, there was a point when the Koch donor network was starting to fear that the Republicans in Congress would not move major legislation. And one of them actually said at a retreat, one of these Koch summits last year, said until they got health care repealed and they got the tax bill, the piggy banks would be closed. I mean, the language was that blunt and crude. The piggy banks would be closed. So now that they have passed this tax bill, which is a huge boon to the Koch network, to corporations. It's got all kinds of time bombs in it that we could come back to, but now they're very happy, and so they're rewarding their loyalists in Congress.
Well, let's go through the what they're trying to do in terms of changing the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty dramatic, and maybe a surprise to most of your listeners, but there are two ways to change the U.S. Constitution. One is through the amendment process that goes through Congress. All this is specified in Article 5 of the Constitution. The other, which has never been done in our history since the Constitution was drafted, is to go through the states. And at this point, the Koch Donor Network, working through the American Legislative Exchange Council and their allied Republican politicians, has lined up 28 of the 34 states needed to authorize such a convention. Again, the first one in our history, it would necessarily be a runaway convention where anything can come on the floor because the Constitution specifies the rules of convening it, but not what happens when you get there. So necessarily a runaway convention, and they need six more states to do it. And one of those time bombs built into the tax scam, as some have called it, is that they will run up the deficit by at least $1.5 trillion by all, you know, reasonable estimates. And I believe that that running up the deficit that you see there and that you saw in the latest budget deal will then become the occasion for Republicans to say, oh, look, we can't even control ourselves. That's why we need a balanced budget amendment. That's why we need a constitutional convention. And the sad and scary fact is there are six states that have not yet authorized a constitutional convention that are controlled both houses by the Republican Party. So that means those last six states could tip quite quickly. And again, this is why I say this is an emergency. This is people who are determined to rewrite the fundamental rules of our democracy. They're not doing so honestly. They're not doing so openly. They're doing so much by stealth. And we have got to pay attention, and we have got to be ready to deal with those things. Now, having said that, I do want to also add that there are really good groups who are dealing with every aspect of this, you know, from the labor unions that are getting ready for this Janus case coming down from the Supreme Court that is intended to devastate public sector unions, to Common Cause is organizing to get states to rescind their authorizations for this constitutional convention. You know, environmental groups are organizing to try to contain the damage. So, you know, on every issue, there are good people out there, but the challenge is that we've been in the silos for so long, you know, on the progressive side of things, and so people have really got to start paying attention to what's happening to our democracy as a key element of their work.
So the distraction with identity politics has been discussed quite a bit, and at this point, it's really about bread and butter issues. And
well, if I might interject, though, Ian, I don't think I it concerns me when people talk about the distraction of identity politics, because I think what we're seeing from certainly Trump is practicing an identity politics. Mm-hmm. He's practicing an identity politics that goes right for this sense of white people who are afraid at the way their country is changing, who are angry, and he goads them to action. And the Koch Donor Network does that too. It's a kind of strategic racism to get people to do what they otherwise would not. So I don't think that it will help us to go back to older formulations about, you know, bread and butter versus identity politics, because I think everybody's talking about identity. But I think what we need is not so much the either or, but the both and kind of framework. Right. So I think there are groups like Black Lives Matter who are raising really fundamental bread and butter questions about how we got mass incarceration and how to deal with it. You know, similarly for women, I mean, being able to control your own reproduction is a bread and butter issue. But I think we need to have a capacious framework that makes everyone feel like, you know, their needs are being taken seriously and their dignity as human beings is valued, yet we have to work in cooperation to save this thing that we all rely on, sure, which is a responsive democracy. And in fact, you know, it hasn't been responsive for a long time. So I think in order to beat back this acute threat, we're going to have to deal with some of these chronic problems that have been festering for decades.
Well, I don't believe they are mutually exclusive. And, of course, the focus, I think, is shifting back and should shift back on what we all have in common in this vast coalition that wants to reject this person that's ruining this country and the people that he's enablers in the Republican House and Senate. So we have to find all kinds of reasons. And we don't have to find them. They're staring us in the face, what we have in common. But this is what worries me most about the right, radical right takeover of the Republican Party. And after all, it was the Koch brothers who engineered this takeover via this Tea Party movement. It's basically supposed to be a grassroots populist movement, but it's actually a total tool of the plutocracy. They don't see the Democrats as the opposition party. They don't want a two-party system. They just want to destroy their totalitarian in their outlook, because look what the Kochs are doing, for example, and how much they're trying to destroy the financial basis of the Democratic Party that makes it viable, union money, for example. With the Janus case, the Supreme Court now with Gorsuch, there was an 8-to-8. There's a case coming out here of California against the teachers' union, which will basically mean that all public employees won't have to pay money to their unions. And that's a source of revenue for the Democrats. Every day, more and more states in this country, through ALEC, the Koch front, are becoming right-to-work states. Mm-hmm. So this is what I think we should focus on, the fact that how deeply undemocratic the Kochs are, and as I say,
anti-democratic.
They don't
say too. Yeah,
they don't want a ruling party and an opposition party. They just want a ruling party.
I think you're right. And I think you've also drawn attention to something that's crucial, which is what's going on in the states. You know, there's a tendency, I think, for much of the media and for many citizens of all kinds to just focus on Washington or perhaps what's going on in their local communities. But right now, much of the real action is going on at the state level. And I think this is particularly important as we're approaching midterm elections, because they require people to focus more on states than the national, you know, and a lot of young people don't. A lot of people who are usual Democratic voters don't pay. You know, there's two different electorates, the midterm electorate and the presidential electorate. And if we go through another midterm election where people aren't paying attention, you know, we could be doomed, frankly, because the right at this point has what the Democracy Alliance calls an electoral stranglehold over 30 states. The Democrats have 6. They have 30. And within those states, they are making radical changes of the kinds that you've described. So it's at the state level that all of these voter suppression measures have gone through. It's at the state level that you get the redistricting that allows these Republican elected officials to choose their voters rather than voters choosing their representatives. It's another way of stealing people's voting power. And you also have these anti-union measures going through at the state level. And another thing we see, and we're seeing this in my own state of North Carolina, and this is, you know, speaking to your point about the almost kind of totalitarian quality of all this, is they are trying in North Carolina now to get rid of the independent judiciary. So they are, because the courts have pushed back at all of these anti-democratic things that they're doing that have violated due process, now they're trying to transform the way that judges are chosen. And so, you know, again, if that's not being covered in the national news, but this is very serious stuff. And it's also happening in conjunction with the Trump administration having appointed more federal circuit court judges than any other modern president. Now, why was he able to do that? Because Mitch McConnell prevented President Obama from exercising the rights of a sitting president and being able to name judges. They held all those judges back and Gorsuch back, and now they're stacking the courts. So, you know, again, you know, there are times, you know, for not paying attention, you know, in public life and tending to your own issues. And I understand how much stress people are under and how many things they have to deal with. But this is a moment when people must pay attention to politics, to what is happening in our states and in our nation. If we care about living in a democracy, if we want to be in a world where we have a government that is responsive to our needs and to crises like, you know, problems with our air and water, climate, global warming, inequality, public health, all of these things that we've been able to take for granted over the 20th century, that government, you know, that in a crisis we could push government to respond, that is being undermined by these people in a very, very systematic way. They are radically rewriting the rules wherever they go. And we have a window to address this, but we have got to pay attention and organize if we want to have a chance of preserving a system freedom that many of us have come to take for granted.
Well, I must say, just in closing, Nancy McLean, that I'm very gratified and quite enthusiastic about the possibility of the very younger generation that are about to turn 18 getting politically active, as these young students who survived the massacre in Florida exhibited an amazing intelligence, amazing understanding of politics, and incredible political passion. And it's hard to believe that the Kochs have pulled such an amazing trick on Americans, and that Citizens United, of course, has so clearly changed the whole landscape. It's now about money politics. Mm-hmm. It's not about candidates, issues, policies, and platforms. That is what's been an amazing achievement on their part. But the idea that any American would not notice that politics are about money, and the people with the money win. And, you know, we've got a lot of people running for Congress, a lot of women are running. And again, there's this struggle between the DCCC and Nancy Pelosi and company, who's saying we just need self-funders with lots of money. And a lot of grassroots candidates are saying, no, let's do what Bernie Sanders did. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to work out. But this blue wave that people are talking about may not happen.
It's possible that certainly if we expect other people than ourselves to do it, it won't happen. And I think we saw that in the 2010 midterms, which helped bring us all this madness because they enabled the redistricting that has transformed our politics so that in my state, even though more people have supported the Democrats than Republicans, the Republicans have the overwhelming number of seats because of the way that they've drawn the district line. So it's really, really a serious problem. But I'm glad you raised the issue of the Bernie-crats and people, because they have also been showing us how to go forward. In Virginia, in just one election cycle earlier this year, the Republican, and again, this is not just regular Republicans, these radicalized Koch Republicans, they had 66 to 34 advantage in Virginia, in the House of Delegates, and that was closed in a single election cycle. And people who have studied the data say that the greatest increases in turnout were in the districts that supported Tom Perriello and Bernie Sanders. So it's those people who are most energized to make change who are making the change, and they did that in Virginia. And I think, as you're saying too, these young people in Florida are inspiring us all. I mean, what a beacon to take that horrible tragedy and loss and just the shock and, you know, everything that goes with a school shooting like that, but to say, no, you know, you can't do this. This must stop. We know that these politicians have been bought by the NRA, and that is not right. And, you know, a government, is its most minimal responsibility is to protect the lives of its people, and particularly its most vulnerable, its children. And the fact that these young people are speaking out so eloquently and moving into organizing to hold elected officials accountable, I think is, as you said, an incredibly inspiring moment. And now I think it's up to the grown-ups among us, too, to make sure that we're out there and we're alongside them and we're saying enough is enough with this takeover of our politics by moneyed interests and by lobbyists like the NRA, which, by the way, works very closely with all the other elements of the Koch donor network.
Well, Nancy McLean, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always good to be with you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Nancy McLean, who's an award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She's the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.